Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A decade ago, with his best-selling book, Race Matters, Cornel West made a celebrated argument that a sense of nihilism had taken over much of black America. Hopelessness, lovelessness, despair. Now, in what he calls a sequel, West describes the entire country, post-9/11, as infected with nihilism, blinded by imperialism, and drifting from its democratic ideals. But American democracy, he says, can be saved. Tonight on Point, Democracy Matters with Cornel West. But first, we begin tonight on the campaign trail in Derry, New Hampshire. President Bush made his ninth visit to the Granite State today. Speaking at a rally in Derry, he struck back moments after John Kerry had delivered a stinging critique of his administration's handling of the Iraq War. Kerry's remarks, Bush said, followed a pattern of, quote, twisting in the wind.
He apparently woke up this morning and has now decided, no, we should not have invaded Iraq. After just last month saying he still would have voted for force, even knowing everything we know today. Incredibly, he now believes our national security would be stronger with Saddam Hussein in power, not in prison.
WBUR reporter Audie Cornish was at the president's New Hampshire campaign stop today, and she joins me now in the studio. Audie, what was the mood in the president's campaign environs today after John Kerry's attack from New York?
Well, it was a soft landing for him because this was a large gathering, a town meeting style meeting with lots of volunteers and people, supporters of the campaign. But the president defended every one of his decisions since the September 11th attacks. And, you know, with John Kerry saying that the president was inconsistent, saying the administration overpromised and underperformed, you use language like that. And the Bush-Cheney campaign is going to fight back because to them, inconsistency has been the hallmark of John Kerry's platform on this issue.
We must show resolve and determination. Mixed signals are the wrong signals to send to the enemy. Mixed signals are the wrong signals to send to the people in Iraq. Mixed signals are the wrong signals to send to our allies. And mixed signals are the wrong signals to send to our troops in combat.
President Bush in Derry, New Hampshire today. As you say, this was a town meeting style. Was this in the typical format where these are screened, almost invited participants?
Very much screened. Almost everyone who got up praised the president. Wasn't a whole lot of tough question asking there. There was one or two people who brought up the issue of stem cell research, but the president mainly went to New Hampshire to talk economy, and it's a good state to do it because their unemployment rate is hovering around 3.5, lower than the national average. Mm. No income tax, low taxation talk does very well there. And the president went through everything from the Social Security personal savings accounts to touting his Medicare prescription drug benefit, even though that's received a lot of criticism. So he was really there to lay out that economic vision. But he definitely took the time out to defend himself against Kerry's comments.
And the president's standing in New Hampshire today compared to how he did in 2000?
Well, like you said, he's been there nine times over the last few months. And even though it's only four electoral votes, people may be wondering, you know, why is he hitting the state so much? Two schools of thought there. The Democrats would say to you, well, it's because he's nervous. But some people would also say that if some of these larger states, if states out in the Northwest with a lot more votes are more evenly split or end up going to Kerry, then a state like New Hampshire could very much make the difference. The Bush family's had a mixed history in New Hampshire. George W. Bush lost the primary to Buchanan when he first ran, even though he later took the state. That was with a 4% take by Nader. Looking at his father back in 88, he won the state the first time, but then lost it 4 years later to Bill Clinton. And so New Hampshire is not a done deal for the Bush campaign.
But President Bush pushing back hard today on the John Kerry speech we heard so much about in our last hour. And presumably this is the posture he'll strike, defiant toward John Kerry.
Yes, the issue is about consistency. The Bush Cheney reelection campaign says they are, and the John Kerry and John Edwards are not, and that it's simple. I counted 3 to 4 different quotes that he used that he said were from John Kerry today that he used in his own stump speech to say to people that this is not a time for us to have someone who is going to say one thing one day and another thing to the next. They're really going to stick to that sort of flip-flopper talk that they've used on John Kerry. It'll be interesting to see if Kerry can sort of squeeze out of it, like with the comments he made today.
Well, and clearly Kerry today trying to turn it around and make that consistency a black mark for George Bush, describing him as essentially as consistently wrong. Audie Cornish, thanks for being there this morning. Thanks for bringing us the report tonight.
Thank you.
Audie Cornish is a reporter for WBUR. She joined me here in the studio in Boston. Public intellectual Cornel West made a mark with his 1993 bestseller, Race Matters. The African-American son of an Air Force administrator and a school principal, West grew up impressed with the Baptist Church and the Black Panthers. He's been an unconventional academic superstar. The Seattle Times called him Soul Brother number one of American intellectuals. After a famous falling out with Harvard President Lawrence Summers, he moved to Princeton. But his wide-ranging critiques go on, now looking well beyond race to examine the health of American democracy itself. And Cornel West is worried. Tonight on Point, Cornel West on democracy and nihilism. Do you see the long shadow that Cornel West describes in American life and politics today? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8225. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Cornel West, professor of religion at Princeton and author of the best-selling book Race Matters. His new book is Democracy Matters, Winning the Fight Against Imperialism. Good evening and welcome, Cornel West.
It's a blessing to be here. Thank you so very much, my dear brother, for having me on your show, though, man.
It's terrific to have you. Cornel West, you bring imperialism into the formula right in the title of the book. What's the connection that you're making between the state of American democracy today and imperialism?
Well, I'm claiming that we live in very, very dark and difficult times, that there's certain dogma that are operating, anti-democratic dogma operating in this precious democratic experiment named the United States. There's a free market fundamentalism in which corporations are fetishized. We ascribe magical powers to them. We have a political system that's characterized in part by legalized bribery, normalized corruption, and institutionalized graft that make it difficult for citizens to feel as if their voices actually make a difference, because the powerful lobbyists and the corporate interests so thoroughly shape not just the politicians, but the framework in which the politicians talk about issues. Over 50% of fellow citizens will not vote at all in one of the most important elections in the history of the American Democratic experiment. Bush, for me, is very dangerous, because when you bring together the dogma of free market fundamentalism, escalating obscene levels of wealth inequality associated with that, and then at the same time you have aggressive militarism abroad as well as at home, the militarizing of everyday life, the domestic violence, the mean-spiritedness and cold-heartedness of fellow citizens vis-a-vis each other, the inability to engage in the art of dialogue, to really hear one another across ideological, racial, and political lines. And then we've got escalating authoritarianism with the USA Patriotic Act. And you know the case of Brother Tariq Ramadan in Notre Dame, whose visa was canceled by the Bush administration. He is an Islamic intellectual concerned about articulating the relation between democracy as well as Islam, but they will not allow his voice. And so we can't even have a robust conversation on the Middle East, let alone the Israeli-Palestinian issue, which is one of the most delicate to talk about. And, of course, now recently at Harvard, with you got Sister Marcy and Lawrence Bobo, who I love dearly, and I'm just as very new from what I hear, that she is denied tenure, one of the superb scholars when it comes to cultural studies and so forth. And so we've got another debate now with Mr. Summers, my dear brother Larry Summers. What kinds of standards of excellence is he actually applying here? What's going on here? Is he also trying to impose certain kind of limits on the kind of voices that have access to the higher institutions of education in our society? These are very frightening events, each and every one of them, on every front. And everyone who loves democracy in the deepest sense ought to be deeply concerned.
Cornel West, we know that you and Harvard Presidents Lawrence Summers have had the sort of a clash of titans, and you write about it in some interesting detail in this book, but I want to get to your big thesis first.
Oh, sure. No, I agree, because I mean, I want to make it part of a whole, but they all are connected in significant ways. Go right ahead.
We hear that, and you describe threats that you see as threats to democracy. You say, as you've outlined, free market fundamentalism, aggressive militarism, and escalating authoritarianism. But would you describe, back to this imperialism charge here, what is the connection or the linkage between what you see as a kind of sickness, in your view, in American democracy and imperialism? What's the link? What's the connection?
Well, the connection is that there's two conceptions of nihilism here that's very important to keep in mind. One is meaninglessness, hopelessness. The other is the assertion of absolute will with no limits, no constraints. No, what Plato would call a nange, nothing to stop it. And when you have a superpower, a hegemon, an empire like the United States, right, which is a real colossus, let's say, with no limits and thinks that it has no limits, then you get a mentality like Thrasymachus in Plato's Republic. Might makes right. Raw force, coercion, mediates how you deal with resolution. And more we see out of the Bush administration, the new hawks in the White House, the new imperialists in his administration, feeling that you not only can shape the world within your own image and interests, but there's no limits. You don't have to listen to critics. You don't have to take them seriously. You can trash them, ad hominem attacks. You can push them in the gutter. You can sissify them. You can do anything other than meet their arguments. And so you end up with a waning of Socratic energy. Socratic energy is a precondition for any democratic project.
Socratic energy as in an active dialogue.
That's right. Giving of reasons, exchange, mediated with some respect and civility, allowing for contestation to take place, allowing for argument to take place. I mean, it's what Socrates called parhesia, right? It was fearless speech, the frank speech, the plain speech, not double speech, not Orwellian speech.
But George Bush describes his efforts on all fronts in terms of hope. We have to push forward courageously in order to remake the world in a brighter form. You're saying it's actually driven by the opposite of hope.
Well, no, I believe in tragicomic hope, but George Bush doesn't talk about hope. He talks about optimism. Optimism is qualitatively different than kind of tragicomic hope I'm talking about. It comes out of blues, jazz, that comes out of those great writers like Tennessee Williams and William Faulkner and Toni Morrison. His optimism is predicated on a Manichaean view of the world of us versus them, an axis of good versus axis of evil, we who are pure and pristine versus they who are dark and impure. Hope comes out of that kind of cheap, dualistic view of the world. Hope comes out of acknowledgement that the good and evil is in us. The good and evil is distributed across the board. We might be better because we're trying to engage in democratic project, but we know that there's deep flaws within our own democratic project. We are not gangsters, for the most part, like Bin Laden and company, but we have gangster elements in our present and in our past. And these particular gangsters who hate us so, why do they hate us so? Why is it that the United States has such intimate relations with Saudi Arabia when Saudi Arabia is autocratic, anti-Semitic, shot through with misogyny, women can't even walk on the same side of the street as men, they can't drive cars, and yet we have a cozy relationship with them, and yet we're so concerned about the freedom of Iraqis when in fact Saddam Hussein was installed by the CIA in 79. Rumsfeld shook his hand in 83, didn't say a mumbling word about the Kurds in the north, the Iraqis being subjugated by the gangster named Saddam Hussein. What kind of hypocrisy are we talking about here if, in fact, Bin Laden, gangster that he is, very clear about that, sees the hypocrisy in the United States? Why is it there's the bias toward the state of Israel and can't hear the cry of the Palestinians? The security of Israel is precious. There's no doubt about that. But there'll never be security when you occupy and subjugate another people. If you're serious about security, you have to listen to cries of justice to set up some kind of means by which the peoples can coexist. No discussion about this. Bush administration, no. We see basically the new hawks tied to the Likud party in Israel. Why not some serious engagement about this? Prophetic Jews, progressive Jews, they can say something about it. Some of them have. Rabbi Michael Lerner and a host of them have. But we need more. Why can't we have a robust discussion that it doesn't fall in the pits of anti-Semitism or anti-Arab racism?
Cornel West,
I'm sorry to go on and on, but brother, these are crucial issues.
You always have a lot to say.
We're talking about the sacred honor of our own children, man. Your children, my children, children across the board, Jewish children in Tel Aviv, Palestinian children in the West Bank.
We hear it, and we're going to hear more of it. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with public intellectual Cornel West about American democracy, the imperialist impulse he sees, and what he sees as a dire threat to America's democratic ideals. His new book is Democracy Matters. You can join the conversation tonight. Is American democracy in as much trouble as Cornel West suggests? Are the country's founding ideals being derailed by free market fundamentalism, militarism, and authoritarianism? Or do you hear an overreaction? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest tonight, Cornel West, author of the new book, Democracy Matters, Winning the Fight Against Imperialism. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you feel a tide of nihilism in American politics today? Who is driving it, if it's there? Are Americans sleepwalking, as Cornel West suggests, or painfully coming to terms with a tough new century? Are Republicans and Democrats both, as West charges, to blame for not being honest in their politics? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Cornel West, you wrote Race Matters, came out in 1993, and you call this book a sequel to that. What do you mean by that?
It's impossible to talk about the vicious legacy of white supremacy independent of the way in which it promotes the arrested development of democracy. Anybody concerned about the humanity of any slice of the human family in the end has to be, I think, morally consistent, especially given what I call the Jewish invention of the prophetic, in which it is international, it is universal, it's critical of any kind of egoism, tribalism, group narcissism, it's concerned with the human family as a whole, each person being equal in that human family, and therefore all of my talk about race has always been cast in a broader context of the Socratic questioning, the broader prophetic justice, and the attempt to hold on to some kind of hope as we struggle against the grain in this dark and difficult situation.
But is race the link between that book and this, or is it the nihilism, the despair? You wrote about a kind of despair then. Now you describe it as more or less a national affliction. Is that the link? That the sequel-making link?
Well, no, I think what I'm doing is I'm looking at the democratic experiment, very precious experiment called the USA, through the lens of race and empire. And when you look at it through the lens of race and empire, then you begin to see very clearly the forms of mendacity and hypocrisy and bellicosity that are shot through America's past and present. The stories about itself that it doesn't want to hear, the critiques of itself it doesn't want to heed. And therefore, the nihilism that we talk about, in a certain sense, is still subordinate to the lens through which I look at democracy. And what's fascinating about democracy is that you actually become more democratic and you become more enlivened to democratic possibilities when you keep track of the anti-democratic dogmas operating in the country. When you look at the dogma of male supremacy, for example, the struggle of women to vote, the struggle of women to be treated equally and with respect, that they made a significant, unprecedented contribution to the expansion of democracy by keeping track of an anti-democratic dogma like male supremacy. Well, when it comes to white supremacy, you can imagine, oh, Brother Tom, we almost lost democracy over that, right, in the Civil War. Mm. We almost lost it again in the 1960s. If it wasn't for Martin King and those who followed him talking about justice opposed to revenge, America could have gone under, brother. You're probably old enough to remember that, right?
Well, I do remember some of that. Let me Absolutely. Ask you this, though. I want to try and get a fix on the baseline that you bring to this, Cornel.
Yes,
you're holding
yes.
up a high standard here. You open the book quoting James Baldwin and Walt Whitman.
And the great Walt Whitman.
And yes, you say indeed. From him, we have frequently printed the word democracy, yet I cannot too often repeat that it is a word the real gist of which still sleeps quite unawakened. Are you saying that America has never really known democracy, or that it knew a fair measure of it and is slipping back from that now? What's the democracy that draw the contrast between what you'd like to see and what you do see?
It's a very good question, though, brother. See, for me, any democratic project is unfinished and incomplete. That the founding fathers did, in fact, affirm democracy. It was just four white brothers with property. So it was a very circumscribed democracy. Democracy is about what? It's about ordinary people, everyday people, taking back the power in the face of elite abuse of power. Well, the anti-imperialist struggle of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson was heroic for me because it was over against an empire. It was over against imperialism. The problem was not only that they were cowardly slaveholders holding on to a dogma of white supremacy, but also they were intended on Western expansion against indigenous peoples. You see the use of savages in the Declaration of Independence, the Empire of Liberty, America's rising empire that George Washington wrote about. So we have to be able to hold both tendencies in our mind at the same time. The rich democratic strand that we see in Washington and Jefferson vis-a-vis the British Empire, and the imperialist strand that we see against peoples of color, red, black, and others. And I don't think there's a problem here because they're human beings. We have these same tendencies in ourselves, though, Brother Tom. So that the question is, how do we accent that democratic one? And if you keep track of race and empire and gender and class, you're more likely to wrestle with the anti-democratic dogmas operating that gives you much more strength, energy, a possibility of expanding democracy. And the problem, of course, of the present administration is that it's quite explicit about its imperialist expansion, both abroad, but also corporate rule at home, curtailing the dialogue at home.
We'll touch that. I'm not sure that everybody will intuitively get your link between the imperial project you describe and democracy. You say we are experiencing the sad American imperial devouring of American democracy. Let's grant you for a moment that there's imperialism underway here. How does imperialism devour democracy?
Well, it begins to devour it. One, when I talk about free market fundamentalism, in fact, 1% of the population on 48% of financial net wealth, which means that wealth inequality can actually crack your body politic in such a way that you have two Americas, three Americas, four Americas. You don't have one body politic that has any kind of trust and confidence across class lines, let alone racial lines. When I talk about escalating authoritarianism, it means, and we've seen a very, very sad situation in Russia, right?
Sure,
what was the logic of the loss of democracy in Russia in the last week? Safety trumps democracy. Security trumps democracy. This is very frightening. Now, granted, you know, Russia's got a long history of authoritarianism. Czars, Stalin, a whole host of thugs in their past who have run Russia. They have a very, very weak, very frail democratic system. But the same logic is at work in certain elements in the Bush administration. Safety, security trumps liberty and democracy. And if they push that too far, my brother, we will not be able to have this interview in the next 5-10 years, let alone 3 or 4.
Now, a lot of
because
Americans,
it would be treasonous, I would be anti-American, I would be unpatriotic, and all I'm trying to do is just be a Christian and a deep Democrat, love my way through the darkness before I die.
And yet you see in the polls, Americans are very concerned about security. And when the Republicans at their convention in New York made a great noise about security, the polls responded.
Well, you know
Americans
what, brother, it wasn't just a great noise. There was a military presence. For the first time in the history of political conventions, you had military generals lined up alongside elected officials saying, if you don't vote for these people, you're going to lose.
I have to say, Cornel West, I saw a lot of brass on the stage at the Democrats' convention as well.
But they had been out of office much longer than a lot of these folk who are that Republican. And the fact that even if you have the Democrat, you're talking about folks fought in Vietnam, though, brother, in the 60s and 70s. That's what they were trying to do. And what were they doing that for? They were trying to get the Bush administration out of the gutter. Trying to sissify John Kerry when the man had the courage, as a well-to-do white brother, and I affirm him for this, to fight in a war that was an army of primarily working class and black and brown folk. That was a heroic thing. What was Bush doing? He was scared. He was on the run. Let's just be honest about it. He didn't want to fight. He wanted to stay at Yale and be pro-war, stay at Harvard and be pro-war, but when he came to really fight in a war, he wanted to send Jamal. He wanted to send the black and the brown and the white working class folk, you see?
We got it. Cornel West, you describe what you call the unprecedented gangsterization of America. What do you mean by that?
I mean, when you reach the point where integrity, truth, principle is subordinate to the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. to get over by any means. Enron, WorldCom, Adelphi, these are the peaks of an iceberg. We see it in the so-called cheating culture. You know the wonderful book by David Callahan. What is it now? 58% of our young people in high school cheat regularly on exams in order to be successful. Well, if success is the major telos, the major end, people will be successful by any means as long as they don't get caught. And corporate greed has run amok. And I don't believe the corporations have any special monopoly on greed. I think greed actually is fairly well distributed across races and classes and civilizations and so forth. But when there's no structures of accountability there, the greed will run amok, and the well-to-do, their greed running amok has deleterious consequences on the other members of the society, because 20% of our children in poverty, the richest nation in the history of the world. How do you account for that? They don't choose to be in that situation. But it's a low priority because the corporate concerns and corporate interests are such that children are more and more just bundles of desires that constitute potential consumers. They're not human beings.
And you call that structure or the exploitation of that gangsterism?
Well, it's gangsterization to the degree to which it begins to run outside of the law, or the law begins to be so bent. Because I do believe that the corporate elites who stole and embezzled billions of dollars of working people's pension are gangsters. I mean, once you show that, they are gangsters. In the same way that, you know, working people are poor people who steal other people's money. That's gangster activity, you see.
Cornel West, his new book is Democracy Matters. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. Jimmy is calling from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hi, Jimmy. You're on the air with Cornel West.
I don't know where to begin after hearing all that.
It's a lot. It's a lot, but it gets your mind popping, doesn't it?
Yeah. I got to say, hi to Dr. West. I read one of his books when I was in school, and then it was at Villanova, so I got to say hi to everyone at Villanova.
Villanova and Philadelphia says hello, brother.
Okay. what's your comment or question, Jimmy?
All right. My question is I can tell, like, what I see is he's a little... Dr. West is a little, like, slanted towards bashing on Bush a little more than Kerry, okay?
Well, but not too much, though. I don't have too much respect for Kerry. I just happen to be forced to vote for him because Nader's telling the truth, but I pray for Nader this time and not vote for him. But Kerry is milquetoast, brother. It's just that Bush is dangerous. But go right ahead.
All right. Well, this is my question. I think this is a major problem in the U.S. foreign policy today. It's not necessarily Iraq and Afghanistan, although I think that's a big problem. I think it's the Palestinian-Israeli problem, and I think until more Americans realize the injustice that Israel is doing to the Palestinians and how slanted our foreign policy is towards Israel, that we're going to have some serious problems in the future as far as our foreign policy is concerned over there, and especially over there in the Middle East. And I'd like Mr. West to just comment on some of the grievances of Palestinians.
Jimmy, we'll have him do that, but let me just ask you first, what about Israeli security? That's been taken quite a pummeling too, hasn't it?
Israelis have that militancy about them already. They are the militant dictatorship. Sure, they're a democracy. For Jewish people, they're a democracy, but if you're not Jewish, you have no rights.
Well, that's not entirely true within Israel, but let us pick it up. Cornel West, Jimmy looks at Israel and the Palestinians, and he's worried.
Well, I think that he's hit on a crucial issue. We just have to proceed very carefully and cautiously here. See, I don't think the United States ought to be ashamed of being committed to the security of a hated people, a despised people, a people who... the Jewish brothers and sisters, their attempts to annihilate every Jew in Europe and the world. The question becomes, how do you have a commitment to the security of a people when, in fact, those same people are occupying and subjugating another people, and, in fact, their security can never be procured until the cry of justice for Palestinian brothers and sisters is heard? So that on the one hand, we ought to have a policy in which Palestinian life is just as valuable as Israeli life, but at the same time, there is something distinctive about Jews in the world, namely that they have been so hated and despised that it's difficult for them to ever gain viable protection.
What do you mean by that?
That protection is crucial.
They can't gain viable protection just because they're up against prejudice, you mean?
Well, it's not just prejudice. It's institutionalized hatred, brother. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what the European Holocaust was about.
Sure.
I speak as a black man because I come out of institutionalized hatred struggles too, right? So the question then becomes, how do we take that security seriously? And how do we take the justice for Palestinian brothers and sisters seriously? And then the third element, which I talk about, of course, in my book, in my chapter, as you know,
yep.
How do we take the autocratic, anti-Semitic, oil-rich Arab states seriously, given the fact that the United States is willing to allow them to get away with things that they would not do if they had artichokes rather than oil?
So you seem to agree with Jimmy that this is a big and core problem. Do you see a difference in the way George Bush and John Kerry might approach it?
Well, I think George Bush's basic affirmation of Sharon's immoral defense of the occupation of the West Bank. I'm glad to see him trying to dismantle the settlements on Gaza Strip, but he does that to do what? To tighten the colonial hold of the occupation on the West Bank. And George Bush gave him the green light. George Bush's father, as you might recall, told Israel, look, you're receiving $3 billion from U.S. taxpayers. That's 50% of the U.S. foreign aid budget, that we ought to have some say in what you're doing in regard to these settlements. On paper, you say you stop it. On the ground, you're not. His father said you must stop. They did stop. His son says what? I greenlight you to do it. Now, that was a change, a fundamental change in U.S. policy, which told the Arab world the United States is so biased and tendentious toward Israel that Palestinian babies and Palestinian bodies have very little value. Now, suicide bombers against Jewish brothers and sisters, I view that as gangster-like. That is as wrong as it comes. So we've got gangster activity on both sides. And that's why this talk about security of Israel, acknowledging there are a slice of Palestinians who do want to push Jewish brothers and sisters into the sea. That's why America must be committed to security. But that security can never, in fact, be procured without coming up with some attempt to address the cries for justice. Well, how do you do that? Well, there ought to be an international force separating the two. There ought to be some pull. There's got to be an end to the occupation, one. I mean, that's the bottom line. You have to have an end to the occupation. You can't occupy a people and keep them in refugee cities for 25, 30, 37, almost 40 years now and think the next generation is not going to do almost anything in order to resist. So you had in occupation, an international force to separate the two states, to ensure that Jews are not attacked viciously, to ensure that Palestinians are not insulted, subjugated, and attacked viciously, and hope that the silent majority of Israeli brothers and sisters and Palestinian brothers and sisters can push back the extremism within their respective communities and live in relative peace.
Well, we got it, Cornel West. We've just got a minute before the break. You know, I took a course from you at Harvard Law a few years back. You talked about
the course with Roberto Unger.
Yes, with Professor Unger.
It was terrific.
Tragicomic hope. Tragicomic.
Yes,
you know, this was the 90s, and I have to tell you, it didn't resonate with me. You know, the 90s, it felt like a new world was being built. I wasn't into tragicomedy. Combined sense of tragedy and comedy. You know, you take this on board, you describe
about Chekhov and Tennessee Williams and the blues, Robert Johnson, Lyra Card, Marina. Yeah.
You describe black America
as... But now resonate with you, though, you're saying, huh?
Well, you describe black America as having been kind of saved by developing this attitude. Do you think America as a whole will ever be able to embrace tragicomic hope as a national state of mind? Is that sufficiently... attractive, compelling to Americans with their history to grab onto that? Maybe let me give you that question and let you sit with it for a moment, because we've got a break coming up, and if you start on that, we'll never get the brakes on before the break. We're with Cornel West tonight. His new book is Democracy Matters. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you hear prophecy in Cornel West or paranoia? Do the lessons of the black American experience now somehow show the way forward for all Americans? Is America ready for tragicomic hope, Cornel West style? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the public intellectual Cornel West about American democracy, the imperialist impulse, and what he sees as a dire threat to America's democratic ideals. He's professor of religion at Princeton University, author of the best-selling Race Matters in 1993. Now he's out with its sequel, as he describes it, Democracy Matters, Winning the Fight Against Imperialism. You can join the conversation tonight. Are the country's founding ideals being derailed by what Cornel West calls free market fundamentalism, militarism, and authoritarianism? Or is Professor West overreacting here? How do you hear it? How do you see it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've got some questions on the table, but we want to get yours, too, and we'll come back to tragicomic hope. Cornel West, Bob's calling from the Bronx in New York. Sure. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for allowing me this opportunity. I would like to comment, first of all, on something that Dr. West had mentioned earlier with regards to nothing to discuss with, and that is because the current administration that we're dealing with is not sophisticated. And these ideas that we're speaking about, tragicomic hope and the like, are sophisticated. The ideology of this administration is rather simplistic, and that's its danger. There is what seems to be a subtle Christian fundamentalism that is driving what we're calling this imperialism. I say this because, having grown up and lived in the Deep South, if you speak to these people, and when I say these people, the modestly affluent, those people who have resources, who have homes, who work hard, and who are what we would call the good Christian, there is a view about the terrorist mentality that it is evil, and even our current president has labeled it as evil. And what happens, as I see it, is that a simple thought of us, the U.S., being good and them being evil gives us carte blanche to do whatever is necessary with a will without limits, as you had said, without constraints, to eradicate this.
Bob, I think we've got it. I want to give it to Cornel West. Mm-hmm. Cornel West, Bob's saying, well, is there a fundamentalism driving what you're describing as American imperialism, that is a Christian fundamentalism?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the Christian right is a fundamental part of the larger right-wing bloc or alliance. You basically got corporate elites who provide big financial support for Christian right leaders. The Christian right leaders sit at the imperial table and are quite comfortable, which is in stark contrast to their savior, who was put to death by the Roman Empire. But I have a whole chapter on Constantinian Jews and Constantinian Christians versus prophetic Jews and prophetic Christians, and what it really means to take seriously the words of Micah in 6:8, to do justly, or Proverbs 14:31, he who is in solidarity with the poor elevates one maker, he who trashes the poor actually trashes one's maker. Those are rich prophetic formulations coming out of Judaism and Christianity that sit very uncomfortably with Constantinian Christians and Constantinian Jews these days.
Pulverized by Constantinian believers, you say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so what I think the brother has a good point, but I want to add, though, that the Manichaean view that he mentioned of the us versus them, the pure heroes versus the impure villains, that this Manichaean view is religiously promiscuous, which is to say it can lie down with a variety of different religions and is ideologically promiscuous. It can lie down with secular folk. So you can have secular folk in the Bush administration who are Manichaean. You can have Jewish folk in the Bush administration who are Manichaean. You can have Christians who are Manichaean, in the same way you can have secular Christian and Jewish brothers and sisters who are prophetic and progressive. They're not in the administration right now, but you can have them, you see. Mm-hmm. And so I do affirm in part what he's saying, but I don't want to make it as if the Christian fundamentalists are in the driver's seat. They are constitutive elements in the right-wing bloc. But I think in the end, it's more corporate elites than anything else. That's who's really driving the agenda, and they're actually manipulating many very sincere and gullible Christians and Jews. I think there's many Christians who have lost connection with the prophetic fervor of their Savior and become comfortable with the institutional practices of their churches. There's many Jewish brothers and sisters who have lost connection with the prophetic words and practices of prophetic Judaism and has become comfortable with assimilated mainstream Americanism as they make their entree, given their upward mobility of the last 45 years
Colonel West, you seem to describe Americans as having drifted away from even a core understanding of what democracy really is. As I read you, you're saying that people are so consumerized that what they call democracy doesn't really stack up to democracy in your terms, and a lot of Americans no longer know the difference.
Well, I think in some ways that's true, but I don't want to suggest that the deep democratic tradition is dead in America. That's why I have that whole chapter, as you know, brother, on the deep democratic tradition. I go back to Ralph Waldo Emerson and his concern, whoso be a man or woman would be a nonconformist, that I must learn how to muster the courage to think critically for myself, that I must be able to connect my individuality with that of others as I hold at arm's length narrow, rapacious individualism, or don't confuse community interests with flag-waving patriotism. One has to do with national glory, the latter. The former has to do with robust citizenship. The two are not always the same. People wave the flag and do in other citizens, right? Too many religious folk, especially Christians, put the flag over the cross, right? And so you end up with a kind of emaciated Christian practice in the name of the flag rather than the cross. So that I don't think that all of us have lost it. It's just that it's there in remnants and relics and ruins that need to be reinvigorated and need to be regalvanized. In the 1860s, it looked like we lost it, but Lincoln and others were able to come through. In the 1890s, with Depression and robust American imperialism abroad, we were able to bounce back. In the 1830s in Depression, 1960s with racial upheaval. And what we need now is a democratic awakening in the first part of the 21st century, and of course this has implications for the world. That's why this book is very much about America's place in the world, because given the Americanization of the world, Walmart, Hollywood, hip-hop, what else, Coca-Cola, what else, McDonald's, these are international phenomena. What happens here has tremendous impact on what goes on in other places.
Let's get another call. Jen is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Jen, you're on the air.
Hi there. Well, first of all, Cornel West, you are one of my heroes, and Race Matters is just such a staple for anti-oppression work, and so thank you.
Thank you so very much, sister.
I guess going into sort of that, the state of the citizens of our democracy, I was just wondering what you thought about the role of media and how earlier you were talking about how democracy is fed by Socratic dialogue, and I feel like the media has sort of taken that away and replaced it with this sort of this class of pundits that supposedly are doing the dialogue for the electorate but don't seem to be.
No, and it's a very important point.
Not fully carrying that broader electorate's view, you're saying, Jen.
Yeah, or not even, I wouldn't say caring, but I don't think understanding the electorate view. And the thing is that because that's the only place we get our political content and our political issues from. It seems like as an electorate, that's part of why we're sort of stepping away, this drift to the middle. Like there's all these things that I think about, how on earth could this electorate be thinking these things? But I think, honestly, the electorate is almost not even involved anymore.
Jen, thanks for that. Let me put it to Cornel West. Jen doesn't buy the dialogue of the crossfire pundits, Cornel West. What about the media's role in your view?
She's got good reason, too, because she recognized, I mean, she knows you can't have a democracy without just rule of law, a robust public education system, and a free press that's actually free, that's willing to be courageous enough to freely ask questions of those who rule us. And right now we've got a corporate domination of the mass media. You've got oligopolies, you've got monopolies that make it very difficult for dissenting voices to surface with power. Then in addition to that, you've got a bottom line, so people don't want to unsettle. They don't want to unnerve their constituencies because they're worried about other competition that makes them feel more comfortable, and therefore it's hard to have a conversation when you're concerned solely about comforting your constituencies. We saw this with the press vis-a-vis the war in Iraq, right? You don't want to tell the truth about what's going on in the Iraqi war. You want to comfort the American people, make them feel good so they keep tuning in. And as long as they tune in and feel good, you think you're really performing your role when you're actually abdicating your role as a member of Free Press because you're not asking the deeper questions. We saw this in press conferences with Bush. Not one critical question raised, the whole thing transcripted, as it were. Why? Because they don't want to be excluded, and two, they don't want to upset the ratings. Look at Phil Donahue. Why was Phil Donahue terminated? He was terminated because he was unsettling people too much during the war.
So don't just dish out the comfort to get the fork in there.
You got to tell the truth. Now, there's ways of telling the truth that still would allow people not to completely shut down, but the Free Press is no longer exercising that kind of parhesia, that fearless, free, plain, frank speech. Now, I should say this. On the Internet, we do have it. There's the Amy Goodmans and many others. Your show itself, Tom, is a crucial public space where dialogue can take place. I don't believe I have a monopoly of the truth. I'm not a relativist. I'm a fallibilist. I think I have a better interpretation than other people. You allow me to speak. I hope you also have centrists. You have liberals. You have conservatives. Is that not right?
And we do.
You have a robust, uninhibited conversation.
We
That's
try.
What the press ought to be about. But see, your show is not paradigmatic. See what I mean?
We try. Let me get back to this.
It was imitated by others.
Let me get back to this tragic comic hope. You see, we've got to have Socratic questioning, tough, rich dialogue. We've got to have prophetic witness, people imagining how it could be. And
willing to sacrifice.
And willing to sacrifice.
Having the courage to care and love.
And then tragic comic hope. Define that, please.
Tragicomic hope is what the blues is all about. It's the ability, the courage to muster a smile in the face of tears, to keep laughing in the face of darkness, not to allow despair to have the last word, even as it looks as if you have a chance of a snowball in hell for your project to be realized. You've been looking up and down for so long, but you keep moving anyway. You've been feeling down for so long that you keep pushing anyway. That's Curtis Mayfield. Mm-hmm. That's Ma Rainey. That's Sarah Vaughan. That's Louis Armstrong. That's John Coltrane. That's even R. Kelly, even though he got problems, that he recognizes that in his latest CD, he's not stepping in the name of love only. He's wrestling with how he can sustain himself given his own negative proclivities. What does that mean? It means you have to be critical of yourself.
Let me ask you this.
Socratic.
We understand this from Black history, and our time is so short, I apologize. But the American dream, you know, that is not something rooted in pain and tragic comedy. The American dream, as popularly understood, is about, you know, reaching for the star. It's all the moonbeams and starlight.
Right.
Can Americans turn to tragic comedy as a sustaining view?
Well, a part of it, I think you're saying, can America move from innocence to corruption without a mediating stage of maturity?
Well, perhaps.
Can America grow big, grow old, and also grow up? Now, turn to F. Scott Fitzgerald, the great Gatsby, the great classic of 1929. You remember Gatsby believed in the green light. Mm-hmm. That was the American dream, the narrow American dream. But he knew he would have to lie. He had to engage in mendacious, hypocritical activity. F. Scott Fitzgerald's an Irish brother who had a tragic comic sensibility. The American Hamlet is Blanche in A Streetcar Named Desire. Tennessee Williams is a white brother born in Columbus, Mississippi, who is a blues man, has a tragic comic sensibility. Melville has his tragic, not really comic, but tragic sensibility that connects to what I'm talking about. The great American truth tellers, be they artists, be they songwriters like Stephen Sondheim and George Gershwin, be they blues artists like Leroy Carr, or be they hip-hop artists like Dead Prez, they recognize that you have to muster the maturity to face truths that are painful. And in the end, America either faces those truths with courage and dignity, very much the way in which Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington faced darkness with dignity and grace, or America loses its democratic experiment. That's why after 9/11, the question is, can a blues nation learn from a blues people? To be black, to be a nigger in America, to be unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence and hated. Now all Americans feel that. Given the niggerization of the nation as a whole, can America respond to their niggerization the way black people have responded in the dominant form to their niggerization, which is Martin King, A. Philip Randolph, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Frederick Douglass, justice, not revenge, trying to sustain a democratic project, not snuffing out with authoritarian, militaristic, and free market fundamentalist ways of doing.
Cornell,
that's the challenge. Many of us willing to live and die for that, my brother.
We hear it. With that, we're out of time. There's so much we didn't get to. You're great for joining us tonight, and thank you.
Thank you so much.
For the new
stay
book.
Strong. You're a force for good, my brother.
a shout out to Lawrence Summers, Cornell West.
I pray for Brother Lawrence Summers. Harvard is a great place, magnificent professors, but I think it's time for the president to think about what he's doing, especially the board of overseers, because Harvard has got to grow.
We got it. Cornell West, his new book is Democracy Matters. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.